ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 24th of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The former UK ambassador to Washington, Peter Mandelson, has been arrested by London police on suspicion of misconduct in public office. It follows the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor over a similar investigation, with both men linked to the convicted sex offender, the late Jeffrey Epstein. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has written a letter to his UK counterpart offering his support for removing the former prince from the line of succession in the British monarchy. The Prime Minister joins me now. Anthony Albanese, thank you for speaking to AM this morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Now, do you want Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor removed from the line of succession?
I certainly do, and I think that Australians will as well. These are very serious allegations. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor will face the full force of the law. His Majesty, King Charles, has said that the law must now take its full course. There must be a full, fair and proper investigation, and that needs to occur. I've written to Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and I've engaged with him as well directly overnight to confirm that my government would agree to any proposal to remove him from the line of royal succession.
Did he ask for your position?
We volunteered. I wrote to him and then I texted with him to tell him that that was on its way, and we engaged, and he thanked me for our position. Any amendment to the line of succession would be initiated by the United Kingdom, and what would have to happen would be that all 14 realm countries in the Commonwealth, that is those who still had the Crown as their head of state, would have to agree. And that's a process that obviously takes time, but the UK would initiate it. All 14 countries would have to agree, and indeed Australia would have to as well get the agreement of our states and territories. And I've written to all the premiers and chief ministers along those lines.
Have you spoken with any of your counterparts in Canada or New Zealand or Papua New Guinea, other countries in the Commonwealth realm about this? Was there any coordination?
We initiated it. Australia likes being first, and we have made sure that everyone knows what our position is, and we'll be writing today to the other realm countries as well, informing them of our position.
Is it appropriate to raise removing the former prince from the line of succession before the investigation is complete? Certainly all the public statements from the UK government thus far have suggested they need to wait for the investigation to wrap up before doing anything. Are you jumping the gun by making this position so public while the investigation is still ongoing?
What we're doing is preparing. And already Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, the fact that we're calling him that rather than Prince Andrew, indicates that there's already been moves along these lines.
This wouldn't be a concern if Australia was a republic with an Australian head of state. Do these events give you any cause to reconsider holding a referendum on becoming a republic?
Well, I haven't changed my position. I'm a Republican. His Majesty King Charles is very aware of that as well, but the government doesn't have any plans to hold a referendum. We're concentrating on cost of living measures, and providing that immediate support for Australians is our priority at this point in time.
Can you explain for me a little more why you want Australia's position to be first in this case? Given there is an active investigation, why do you feel a desire to be at the front? Why are you making this public intervention now?
Well, His Majesty has already intervened and made a clear position about having a full, fair and proper investigation and it taking its full course. I think Australians want to know that the Australian government regards these allegations and regards Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as being not appropriate to be in the line of succession, to be our head of state. I think that Australians are disgusted by all of the revelations about the Epstein files and the connections between Epstein and various public figures. And they want the Australian government to be clear about our position. And that is precisely what I've done.
I want to talk about another issue that has been prominent in national discussion over the last few weeks, and that's the repatriation of Australian families linked to Islamic State. Political circumstances on the ground in Syria really are changing quickly, and there is an intention to shut down the Al-Roj camp that they're housed in. Do you realistically think that you can keep them from ever returning to Australia?
What we have said very clearly is that Australia is not and will not repatriate people from these camps in Syria. That's a position in which one of the non-government organisations took the federal government to court. We won that case, and our position has not changed.
Sure, I understand that, and that's been consistent, but there are other ways for them to return to Australia without the assistance of the government. Do you think their return is inevitable at some point?
They will have decisions to make. And for those people who potentially are facing charges, should they return to Australia, they'll be considering that issue as well. But we are not repatriating them. Australian citizens do have rights, of course, and we've said that as well. But if any do return, it won't be with Australian government support. And if there are, it is possible to lay any charges against any of these individuals, then that will occur.
If they do manage to return, and they've indicated they want to return, what's the value in doing anything that would delay their return? If they spend more time with children in harmful situations and potentially under dangerous influence, would an earlier return to limit that dangerous influence be better in the long term?
Well, they're the ones who made the decision. I'll tell you what would have been better for them: not to make a decision to go overseas to give support to Islamic State, who wanted a caliphate and were essentially at war with Australia.
But the circumstances we're in now is that that has happened. So given these children are now in a potentially dangerous position for political influence and potentially physically harmful situations, the reality of what they face now, would it be better in the long term if they spend less time in that situation?
I am sympathetic with the children, but the children have been put in that position by their parents. And that is something that the Australian government didn't do. We, of course, had very clear warnings. We weren't the government at the time that most of these people, or potentially all of them, went overseas and made that decision. They made that decision. There are consequences for it. And those consequences are that the Australian government's position is that we are not going to provide support for them to be repatriated, and that if they do return, then they will face the full consequences of their action to the full force of the law.
Are you willing to make changes to legislation to make it harder for them to return, or do you want the status quo to remain in place?
Oh, look, there's been some nonsense that was not thought through in order to get a headline from the coalition. They themselves couldn't explain how that was constitutional.
Opposition aside, Tony Burke has talked about the difficulty of the threshold that's required to impose temporary exclusion orders. Would you be willing, for example, to change those thresholds to make it easier to keep people away if that is what the outcome you would like to see?
Well, the full force of the law has been implemented to the extent that we can. There are constitutional issues. The coalition is conscious of that, which is why the laws that are operating are the laws that were put in place by the former government on the basis of the advice. They're the strongest laws that could possibly be actually implemented and not knocked over in the High Court.
So you're satisfied that what is in place is the right regime?
I'm satisfied that every attempt has been made to put in place the strongest laws that are possible.
Prime Minister, I know that you are very passionate about infrastructure, having been a former infrastructure prime minister, minister. The government is tipping more money into high-speed...
I like the first title as well, thank you.
Oh, infrastructure prime minister, I will certainly add that one to your business card. Your government's putting in another $230 million to high-speed rail between Sydney and Newcastle to fund the detailed planning work so that it will be shovel-ready in 2 years. I think a lot of people, when they hear discussion about progression of high-speed rail, are a bit sceptical about when it might appear. So can you give us any answers on some of the really fundamental questions of how much it will cost, how it will be funded, and how long it would take to build?
Well, that is why we are doing this extensive study through the High Speed Rail Authority that we've established, detailed metre-by-metre planning, looking at the design, the approval process, the scope and the cost to make the project shovel ready over the next 2 years. We know that the corridor between Newcastle and Sydney contains a large portion of the Australian population and is continuing to grow. And we know also that the motorway and the existing railway that's there, that frankly is way, way out of date, will be at capacity. So this is something that would also unlock housing, thousands of jobs, generate tens of billions of dollars of new economic activity. So we will undertake this work. It would be a game changer for economic growth and for productivity.
So those questions of a cost and how it will be funded, that won't come until the end of this, the next 2 years, so 2028, is that right?
Well, part of the work that will be undertaken is looking at potential public and private financing options as well. I think in order for this to proceed, it would require significant private funding, and that is something that will be examined as part of this whole process of getting it right.
Finally, Prime Minister, we've had news overnight that the US is pulling non-essential staff out of their embassy in Beirut, given the increasing risk of conflict between the US and Iran. Do you have any advice for Australians who are in the region or considering travelling to the region?
We continue to update all of our advice on the DFAT website and Smart Traveller. And we have already said, if you look at that advice in the Middle East, it's not something that we recommend. There are various levels of warning, but essentially this is not a tourist destination. We should make sure that people do follow that advice, because we don't want people to be caught up in a dangerous situation.
Prime Minister, thanks very much for joining us on AM.
Thanks very much, Melissa.
The war in Ukraine is now entering its fifth year, and while negotiations are continuing in an effort to reach a peace deal, there is no end in sight. Hundreds of thousands of people, both soldiers and civilians, have been killed in the conflict, and in Ukraine, 80,000 people remain missing. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss filed this report.
It's the early hours of the morning, and Dr. Boris Todorov is racing through Kyiv as Russian drones shower the city. He's on a critical mission to deliver a heart for transplant.
It's very dangerous to stay in Kyiv. Every night, missiles and drones killed a lot of people every night.
When the war broke out, he and his team at the Heart Institute in Kyiv's capital made a decision to stay.
It was a difficult decision 4 years ago, because Russian army stay only 10 kilometers from our hospital. But we thought in that time about our special mission, because we are doctors.
It's been 4 years since Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands are estimated to have been killed, and 80,000 Ukrainians are reported missing. Ruslana Bronovitska's son, Dmytro Paska, was missing in action for 2 years.
When I realised that my son was truly gone, it was an enormous blow to my psyche, my emotions, my inner world.
Then, in November, the family received a call from investigators. They had a DNA match and were 99.9% sure they'd found Dmytro's body. She was finally able to lay him to rest in December.
Living in uncertainty is far harder than even receiving the news that you'll have to say goodbye to your son.
There's an overwhelming amount of work to do.
No country can really deal with the numbers that they're currently having to examine and record.
Australian anthropologist Dr. Soren Blau spends weeks at a time in Ukraine, helping local authorities identify the bodies Russia is sending back after both countries signed a deal to repatriate the fallen. After spending two decades at the Victorian Institute of Medicine, she now works with the International Commission on Missing Persons, an intergovernmental organisation helping countries identify the dead.
The sort of key point in all of this is actually a missing persons report. So our engagement with families is critical.
While the fight to bring closure for families continues, the war grinds on. Leading Russia expert Dr. Fiona Hill doesn't see any end in sight.
Anybody who's hoping for peace, the prospects are not really great at the moment. Russia certainly has the capacity to keep going, you know, for the foreseeable future, certainly, you know, through this year.
Since the end of January, Ukraine has regained control of 400 square kilometres of territory, including eight settlements along the southern flank of the front line. The rare battlefield gains a triumph for Kyiv, as it aims to show the world and the US President Donald Trump it's still in this fight, as Washington pressures Ukraine to sacrifice territory in return for a peace deal. This is Catherine Deese in London, reporting for AM.
A top European intelligence official has warned the Kingdom of Denmark is facing the most serious challenge to its sovereignty since the Second World War, under threat from both the United States and Russia. The country is now embarking on its biggest military build-up in decades, and for the first time, conscripting women into its armed forces. Bridget Rollison reports from Denmark.
On a freezing military base in western Denmark, a platoon of young military recruits is learning how to fire in the field.
I find it very fun because it requires focus, quickly move between targets, and being able to just hit. Pretty cool. It's a cool skill.
As Denmark finds itself under threat on two fronts, it's now compulsory for all 18-year-old Danish women to register for the military for the first time. If the armed forces doesn't get enough volunteers, they could be called up to serve. The move comes as US President Donald Trump's recent threats to seize Greenland, an autonomous region of Denmark, shocked the nation.
By turning on an ally like Denmark, there's a sense of betrayal and a sense of being stabbed in the back.
Former chief analyst of the Danish Defence Intelligence Service, Jacob Karsbo, says it's been a turning point.
It's the most direct challenge to Danish territorial integrity and sovereignty since we were attacked by Nazi Germany in 1939.
The unexpected threat from within the NATO alliance comes as Denmark faces rising Russian aggression after a wave of drone incursions widely blamed on Moscow. As a result, Denmark is embarking on its biggest military build-up in decades, investing billions of dollars in fighter jets, drones and ships. Head of Danish conscription, Colonel Kenneth Strem, says the country is also tripling the length of its military service to 11 months in preparation.
I think that everyone would like to have no war, but that might not be the reality. Based on the Danish Defence Intelligence Service, Russia could pose a threat towards the Baltic region within 2 years.
Many in Denmark believe the falling out with the US over Greenland has left it more exposed to Russia.
I'm sure Putin would be delighted with what he's seeing. It's what the Russians and what the Kremlin has been striving for many years, because NATO has always been their main enemy and it's playing right into his whole argument.
Jacob Karsbo says Europe should forge a military alliance that doesn't rely on the US. He warns the feud with America will likely flare up again, despite Donald Trump dialing back his most inflammatory rhetoric to take over Greenland.
We don't know, so we have to be prepared.
Jacob Karsbo, former chief analyst of the Danish Defence Intelligence Service, ending that report from Bridget Rollison in Denmark. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump's tariffs are illegal. That's according to the US Supreme Court. So when will President Trump give back to Australian companies the millions of dollars they've already lost? Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder on the latest tariff chaos and what it means for the global economy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.